Welcome to Congress in Context, the deep dive where we cut through the noise and pull out the essential insights from the week's legislative action.
Our mission today is focused on the critical first week of December. We've got a whole stack of sources here covering, well, high-stakes affordability debates, a fundamental clash over energy policy, and some really interesting bipartisan movement on justice and small business reform.
The narrative coming out of Washington right now is really defined by these impending legislative deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing Congress try to manage, it seems, two totally distinct categories of issues.
What are those?
You've got these massive, polarized fiscal cliffhangers on one hand, and then on the other, surprisingly detailed, kind of common sense bills that are actually getting passed. I want to show you both sides.
And those deadlines are not academic at all. They have immediate, measurable consequences for millions of Americans, starting with healthcare.
Okay, let's unpack that immediate crisis, the Affordable Care Act subsidy cliff. We're talking about the enhanced premium tax credits. They're scheduled to just vanish at the end of the year.
Right, and that's going to impact an estimated 24 million people.
Wow.
The word catastrophic is being used by policy analysts, and, you know, the numbers really bear that out. Our sources cite some pretty stark examples of the projected increases if Congress fails to act.
Like what?
Well, imagine a 60-year-old couple in Wisconsin. They're earning about $85,000 a year. Their health insurance premiums could jump by over $23,000 per year.
$23,000. That is nearly $2,000 extra every single month.
Exactly. And for a family of four earning, say, $133,000, they could be looking at a $14,000 annual increase.
I mean, these aren't just budget adjustments. They require fundamental lifestyle changes. You're talking about potentially delaying retirement, pulling money from savings, or maybe just foregoing coverage entirely.
And critics, largely from the Democratic side, are quick to connect the situation right back to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which Republicans passed back in June.
Right.
They argue that measure intentionally made this crisis worse by cutting $1 trillion from Medicaid and eliminating premium subsidies for 22 million Americans.
And there's a really nuanced detail in that June bill that speaks to this deeper issue of healthcare infrastructure. It's about a cap on student loans for nurses.
Yeah, an unindexed $100,000 hard cap on graduate student loans. The argument is that this actively discourages students from pursuing advanced nursing degrees, which, you know, just compounds the critical short staffing problems we already have.
So the political stalemate is, it's very real.
It's concrete. When Democrats pushed to extend the premium tax credit, that was H.R. 6074, the attempt to even bring the bill up for a vote was blocked by the Republican majority during a procedural rules debate.
This brings up a critical question for you, the learner. Why? Why would one side risk such a massive premium increase for middle-class voters? Is the political gain of forcing a restructuring really worth that immediate pain?
And that raises a really important question about fundamental reform versus, you know, just temporary relief. The Republican counterargument is that the current ACA structure is just fundamentally flawed.
Was there evidence for that?
They point out that premiums have gone up 221% since the exchanges opened. And they cite examples where subsidies are going to high-earning individuals, sometimes people earning over $500,000 without proper oversight.
So for them, this cliff is leverage.
It's leverage to force a structural reform to make the system truly affordable rather than just extending what they see as a broken system.
So it's the classic Washington binary.
Yeah.
An emergency extension or force a long-term fix.
Exactly. But, okay, stepping away from that massive, highly partisan fiscal cliff, we actually saw Congress demonstrate this week that when the political stakes are a little lower, they can govern effectively on technical issues.
That spirit of cooperation really shines through in the healthcare innovation space, for instance, with the hospital at home extension.
Yes. This measure is all about extending a crucial waiver for 5 years, which gives providers the certainty they need to invest in these innovative models.
And this isn't theoretical, right?
Not at all. One health system accepted over 800 patients under this waiver. It freed up 1,500 bed days and saved them $1.1 million.
Okay, so to crystallize that for the listener, hospital home is cheaper, patients generally prefer it, and it frees up scarce resources in physical hospitals. That just seems like policy consensus driven purely by positive outcomes.
And we saw that same common sense approach in justice reform. We tracked significant bipartisan action on the Trafficking Survivors Relief Act. That's H.R. 4323.
This bill is huge. It creates a consistent federal pathway for human trafficking victims to vacate criminal convictions and expunge arrest records for offenses they committed as a consequence of being victimized.
Which is key. And this relief already exists in almost every state, but there's no uniform federal process.
This also sets up a formal legal defense, doesn't it?
It does. It formally establishes a human trafficking duress defense for prosecution of certain federal offenses. It's an overdue recognition that victims of these horrific crimes are often compelled to commit other crimes under extreme duress.
And following that same theme of just clarifying the law, we saw Representatives Roy and McBath co-lead the bipartisan Count the Crimes to Cut Act, H.R. 2159.
The objective here is so simple, but so essential. Define clearly what conduct is criminal at the federal level.
I mean, you'd think that would already be clear.
You would. As one member said during the debate, freedom collapses when the law becomes unknowable. When the federal criminal code is so large and diffuse that even experts can't agree on how many laws exist, it creates a system where prosecutors have excessive power. That's why this has bipartisan support. It's about accountability for the legislature.
It's clear Congress can tackle bureaucracy and injustice, but when we turn to the issues that really define the parties, like capital access, energy, executive oversight, that spirit of cooperation seems to just vanish immediately.
Yeah, let's look at economic oversight. Small business support was a major theme in committee work. Specifically, small American manufacturers, who account for what, 98% of all U.S. manufacturing companies, they're getting a potential capital boost with H.R. 3174.
So what does that bill actually do?
It seeks to raise the SBA 7A and 504 loan limits for small manufacturers from $5 million to $10 million. This is all about providing significant capital to invest in new tech, hire workers, and specifically encourage the reshoring of jobs.
So a direct effort to strengthen domestic manufacturing.
Zach.
You know, the most insightful bill for economic development this week for me was H.R. 4431, the ICANN Act. It's aimed at democratizing venture capital. And this is a fascinating issue because currently the venture capital map is extremely concentrated.
It's shockingly concentrated. Our sources show that nearly half of all U.S. venture funding goes to companies in California,
Half.
and over 70% is concentrated in just four states: California, New York, Massachusetts, and Texas.
So the goal of the ICANN Act is to amend the definition of venture capital fund. How does changing a technical definition like that help spread the wealth?
Well, by broadening the definition, it allows non-accredited investors, you know, average Americans, to participate in certain qualified funds. It lowers the barriers to entry for local Main Street investors who want to support local startups.
So it's about fostering growth outside of those major hubs.
Right. An entrepreneur in Spartanburg, South Carolina, needs access to local capital just as much as one in Silicon Valley. This bill tries to make that possible by tapping into community wealth.
That makes perfect sense. Now, on the oversight front, Congress is clearly reacting to the sheer scale of the COVID-era spending failures. I mean, the numbers are just staggering.
They are. The SBA's Inspector General estimated in 2023 that over $200 billion in potentially fraudulent COVID-era loans and grants were distributed.
200 billion.
Just think about that for a second. That level of loss fundamentally undermines taxpayer trust in the entire system.
And so the legislative response is aimed at stopping future hemorrhaging. We saw bills focused on reducing regulatory burden, the red tape bills, alongside measures to fight fraud.
Precisely. Bills like H.R. 4305 want to codify the SBA red tape hotline to make it easier for businesses to report these unnecessary hurdles. At the same time, Congress wants to require annual reports on the total cost of all federal regulations.
Which is a huge hidden cost, right?
One source estimated it at $2.155 trillion annually on the economy. So reducing that friction is seen as essential for growth.
And finally, a brief note on Social Security. The House passed bipartisan measures, H.R. 5348 and 5349, to improve customer service, especially for identity theft victims, and to help people who retired early because of confusing language from the SSA. Small but meaningful fixes.
Now let's pivot to the major political votes that dominated the Senate floor this week, specifically the energy showdown regarding the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR.
This is a close and significant vote. The Senate passed H.J. Res. 131 by a vote of 49 to 45. It was a formal disapproval of executive action, but what exactly was the mechanism here?
This was a disapproval resolution under the Congressional Review Act, or the CRA. For the listener, the CRA is a really powerful tool Congress can use to nullify a recent executive agency rule or action.
And in this case, the action was the Biden administration's 2024 record of decision on oil and gas leasing in ANWR's coastal plain.
That's right.
And what did that ROD do that Congress wanted to nullify?
The Biden ROD had closed off 76% of that coastal plain. It's known as the 1002 area to any oil and gas leasing.
76%.
Yeah. And supporters of the disapproval resolution argued that this closure violated the clear congressional mandate that was established in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which explicitly required two lease sales in that area.
So the argument for nullifying the action was twofold. One, uphold the congressional mandate, and two, restore access to an estimated 7.7 billion barrels of oil.
And also to support the local Inupiat community and the North Slope borough, who really rely on those oil taxes for essential services like education and police.
But on the other side, opponents view the coastal plain as, I think the quote was, the biological beating heart of the refuge. They call it America's Serengeti.
Mm-hmm. They criticize the push for any industrial development in what they see as a vulnerable ecosystem, emphasizing the critical role the land plays for caribou herds and other wildlife. It's just a fundamental, uncompromising clash between domestic energy supply and environmental preservation.
Okay, moving to national security. The House passed several measures targeting foreign influence in education. Specifically, H.R. 1049, the TRACE Act, and H.R. 1069, the PROTECT Act.
And that last one is aimed at banning CCP funding in K-12 schools. The driving force here is the fear of, well, communist propaganda and threats to national security. The TRACE Act passed quite strongly, 247 to 166.
But there was pushback on this, right?
There was. Opponents argue these bills impose unfunded mandates on already struggling school districts, forcing them to divert resources to bureaucratic reporting on what they claim is an unproven threat at the elementary and secondary level.
Finally, we need to address the deepening tensions over security failures and the scope of executive power. The tragic attack on National Guardsmen Sarah Beckstrom and Andrew Wolf by an Afghan national was highlighted on the floor this week.
That incident points directly to major security gaps and, you know, incomplete vetting for the more than 77,000 Afghan parole recipients. A recent Inspector General report from DHS confirmed there was no established process for even monitoring the parole expiration for this population.
So there's a significant risk in the security vetting process that Congress is now demanding answers on.
Exactly. And then you have the ongoing scrutiny of Secretary Hegseth regarding these alleged illegal strikes on drug boats in the Caribbean. That remains a huge controversy.
Congress has formally requested the full, unedited tapes, the intelligence, all the legal rationale for these strikes,
which the administration has refused to release. And the concern is substantial because members of Congress fear the strikes, which allegedly killed survivors, may have been conducted without legal authorization,
potentially exposing U.S. service members to legal consequences.
Right. The administration's refusal to provide the legal justification just magnifies all the questions about accountability and, frankly, potential executive overreach in military command.
And we also saw the president asserting his authority to replace the FHFA Inspector General, that's the Federal Housing Finance Agency, with his own appointee, arguing that Congress can't limit his power to remove officers.
These actions, from the Hegseth controversy to the FHFA action, they really underscore a growing and fundamental tension between the executive branch's assertion of authority and Congress's duty to provide robust oversight. It's a structural clash that's going to continue.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner, especially as we head into the next legislative cycle? The most immediate policy impact is definitely in the ACA credits. If Congress doesn't resolve this stalemate in the coming weeks, millions of Americans will face those catastrophic premium hikes starting January 1st.
And the core of the debate remains extension without reform versus comprehensive structural changes. If affordability matters to you, track the Committee on Ways and Means in the House and the Finance Committee in the Senate. They hold the key to H.R. 6074 and any related legislation.
For those bills we discussed that actually found some bipartisan success, like H.R. 4333, the Trafficking Survivors Relief Act, or H.J. Res 131 on ANWR, you can easily find the full text and status on congress.gov. Just use the bill numbers. They're your pathway into the legislative process.
You know, if we look back across the source material from this week, the contrast is so stark. We saw clear bipartisan success on complex technical issues, modernizing SBA loans, helping trafficking victims, cutting red tape.
But then deep, seemingly unbridgeable polarization on the massive, high-stakes fiscal cliffs like ACA subsidies and fundamental resource policy like ANWR.
Which leads to our final provocative thought for you to mull over. If consensus is demonstrably possible on nuanced issues of justice and capital flow, what fundamental forces, structural, political, or economic, prevent resolution on issues of national affordability and energy security, especially when the consequences for everyday Americans are so immediate and severe?
Something to track as these debates head toward their inevitable deadlines.
We'll see you next time for the next deep dive.